Chapter 8. But first, we had to get there. It was 8 miles from Klingman's Dome to U.S. 441, the first paved road since Fontana Dam 4 days before. Gatlinburg lay 15 long, twisting downhill miles to the north. It was too far to walk, and it didn't seem likely that we would get a lift hitching in a national park. But in a parking area nearby, I noticed 3 homeward-bound youths loading packs into a large, fancy car with New Hampshire license plates, and impulsively I went and introduced myself to them as a fellow citizen of the Granite State, and asked them if they could find it in their hearts to take 2 weary old guys into Gatlinburg. Before they could demur, which was clearly their instinct, we thanked them profusely and climbed into the back seat. And thus we secured a stylish but rather sullen passage to Gatlinburg. Gatlinburg is a shock to the system from whichever angle you survey it, but never more so than when you descend upon it from a spell of moist, grubby isolation in the woods. It sits just outside the main entrance to Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and specializes in providing all those things that the park does not, principally slurpy food, motels, gift shops, and sidewalks on which to waddle and dawdle, nearly all of it strewn along a single, astoundingly ugly main street. For years it has prospered on the confident understanding that when Americans load up their cars and drive enormous distances to a setting of rare natural splendor, what most of them want when they get there is to play a little miniature golf and eat dribbly food. Great Smoky Mountains National Park is the most popular national park in America, but Gatlinburg, this is so unbelievable, is more popular than the park. So Gatlinburg is appalling, but that's okay. After 8 days on the trail, we were ready to be appalled, eager to be appalled. We checked into a motel, where we were received with a palpable lack of warmth, got honked at twice as we crossed Main Street, one rather loses the knack of crossing roads on the trail, and finally presented ourselves at an establishment called Jersey Joe's Restaurant, where we ordered cheeseburgers and cokes from a charmless, gum-popping waitress who declined to be heartened by our wholesome smiles. We were halfway through this simple, disappointing repast when the waitress dropped the bill on the table as she passed. It came to $20.74. "You're joking," I spluttered. The waitress, let's call her Betty Slutz, stopped and looked at me, then slowly swaggered back to the table, staring at me with majestic disdain the while.
"You got a problem here?"
$20 is a bit much for a couple of burgers, don't you think?" I squeaked in a strange, never-before-heard Bertie Wooster voice. She held her stare for another moment, then picked up the bill and read it through aloud for our benefit, smacking each item as she read.
"2 burgers, 2 sodas. State sales tax, city sales tax, beverage tax, non-discretionary gratuity. Grand total, $20.74.
She let it fall back onto the table and graced us with a sneer.
"Welcome to Gatlinburg, gentlemen."
Welcome indeed. And then we went out to see the town. I was particularly eager to have a look at Gatlinburg because I had read about it in a wonderful book called The Lost Continent. In it, the author describes the scene on Main Street thus. Walking in an unhurried fashion up and down the street were more crowds of overweight tourists in boisterous clothes, with cameras bouncing on their bellies, consuming ice creams, cotton candy, and corn dogs, sometimes simultaneously. And so it was today. The same throngs of pear-shaped people in Reeboks wandered between food smells, clutching grotesque constables and bucket-sized soft drinks. It was still the same tacky, horrible place. Yet I would hardly have recognized it from just 9 years before. Nearly every building I remembered had been torn down and replaced with something new, principally mini-malls and shopping courts, which stretched back from the main street and offered a whole new galaxy of shopping and eating opportunities. In The Lost Continent, I gave a specimen list of Gatlinburg's attractions as they were in 1987. The Elvis Presley Hall of Fame, National Bible Museum, Stars Over Gatlinburg Wax Museum, Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum, American Historical Wax Museum, Gatlinburg Space Needle,
Bonnie Lou and Buster Country Music Show, Carbo's Police Museum, Guinness Book of World Records Exhibition Center, Erlene Mandrell Hall of Stars Museum and Shopping Mall, a pair of haunted houses, and three miscellaneous attractions, Hillbilly Village, Paradise Island, and World of Illusions. Of these 15 diversions, just three appeared to be still in existence 9 years later. They had, of course, been replaced by other things, a mysterious mansion, hillbilly golf, a motion master ride, and these in turn will no doubt be gone in another 9 years, for that is the way of America. I know the world is ever in motion, but the speed of change in the United States is simply dazzling. In 1951, the year I was born, Gatlinburg had just one retail business, a general store called Ogle's. Then, as the post-war boom years quickened, people began coming to the Smokies by car, and motels, restaurants, gas stations, and gift shops popped up to serve them. By 1987, Gatlinburg had 60 motels and 200 gift shops. Today, it has 100 motels and 400 gift shops. And the remarkable thing is that there is nothing remotely remarkable about that. Consider this. Half of all the offices and malls standing in America today have been built since 1980. Half of them. 80% of all the housing stock in the country dates from 1945. Of all the motel rooms in America, 230,000 have been built in the last 15 years. Just up the road from Gatlinburg is the town of Pigeon Forge, which 20 years ago was a sleepy hamlet, nay, which aspired to be a sleepy hamlet, famous only as the hometown of Dolly Parton. Then the estimable Ms. Parton built an amusement park called Dollywood. Now Pigeon Forge has 200 outlet shops stretched along 3 miles of highway. It is bigger and uglier than Gatlinburg, and has better parking, and so, of course, gets more visitors. Now compare all this with the Appalachian Trail. At the time of our hike, the Appalachian Trail was 59 years old. That is, by American standards, incredibly venerable. The Oregon and Santa Fe trails didn't last as long. Route 66 didn't last as long. The old coast-to-coast Lincoln Highway, a road that brought transforming wealth and life to hundreds of little towns, so important and familiar that it became known as America's Main Street, didn't last as long. Nothing in America does. If a product or enterprise doesn't constantly reinvent itself, it is suspended, cast aside, abandoned without sentiment in favor of something bigger, newer, and alas, nearly always uglier. And then there is the good old AT, still quietly ticking along after 6 decades, unassuming, splendid, faithful to its founding principles, sweetly unaware that the world has quite moved on. It's a miracle, really. Cats needed bootlaces, so we went to an outfitter's, and while he was off in the footwear section, I had an idle shuffle around. Pinned to a wall was a map showing the whole of the Appalachian Trail on its long march through 14 states, but with the eastern seaboard rotated to give the AT the appearance of having a due north-south orientation, allowing the mapmaker to fit the trail into an orderly rectangle, about 6 inches wide and 4 feet high. I looked at it with a polite, almost proprietorial interest. It was the first time since leaving New Hampshire that I had considered the trail in its entirety, and then inclined closer, with bigger eyes and slightly parted lips. Of the 4 feet of trail map before me, reaching approximately from my knees to the top of my head, we had done the bottom 2 inches. I went and got Katz and brought him back with me, pulling on a pinch of shirt sleeve. "What?" he said. "What?" I showed him the map. "Yeah, what?" Katz didn't like mysteries. "Look at the map, and then look at the part we've walked." He looked, then looked again. I watched closely as the expression drained from his face. "Jesus," he breathed at last. He turned to me, full of astonishment. "We've done nothing." We went and got a cup of coffee and sat for some time in a kind of dumbfounded silence. All that we had experienced and done, All the effort and toil, the aches, the damp, the mountains, the horrible stodgy noodles, the blizzards, the dreary evenings with Mary Ellen, the endless, wearying, doggedly accumulated miles, all that came to 2 inches. My hair had grown more than that. One thing was obvious. We were never going to walk to Maine. In a way, it was liberating. If we couldn't walk the whole trail, we also didn't have to, which was a novel thought that grew more attractive the more we considered it. We had been released from our obligations, a whole dimension of drudgery, the tedious, mad, really quite pointless business of stepping over every inch of rocky ground between Georgia and Maine, had been removed. We could enjoy ourselves. So, the next morning, after breakfast, we spread our maps across my motel room bed and studied the possibilities that were suddenly opened to us. In the end, we decided to return to the trail not at Newfound Gap, where we had left it, but a little farther on, at a place called Spivey Gap, near Ernestville. This would take us beyond the Smokies, with its crowded shelters and stifling regulations, and put us back in a world where we could please ourselves. I got out the yellow pages and looked up cab companies. There were 3 in Gatlinburg. I called the first one. "How much would it be to take 2 of us to Ernestville?" I inquired. "Dunno," came the reply. This threw me slightly. "Well, how much do you think it would be?" "Dunno." "But it's just down the road." There was a considerable silence, and then the voice said, "Yep." "Haven't you ever taken anybody there before?"
"Nope."
"Well, it looks to me on my map like it's about 20 miles. Would you say that's about right?"
Another pause.
"Might be." "And how much would it be to take us 20 miles?
"Don't know."
I looked at the receiver. "Excuse me, but I just have to say this. You are more stupid than a paramecium." Then I hung up.
"Maybe not my place to say," Katz offered thoughtfully, "but I'm not sure that's the best way to ensure prompt and cheerful service."
I called up another cab company and asked how much it would be to Ernestville.
"Don't know," said the voice.
"Oh, for Christ's sake," I thought.
"What do you want to go there for?"
demanded the voice.
"Pardon?
What do you want to go to Ernestville for? 'Tain't nothing there." "Well, actually, we want to go to Spivey Gap. We're hiking the Appalachian Trail, you see."
"Spivey Gap's another 5 miles.
"Yeah, I was just trying to get an idea."
"You should have said so, 'cause Spivey Gap's another 5 miles.
"Well, how much would it be to Spivey Gap, then?"
"Don't know."
"Excuse me, but is there some kind of gross stupidity requirement to be a cab driver in Gatlinburg?"
"What?"
I hung up and looked at Katz.
"What is it with this town? I've blown more intelligent life into a handkerchief."
I called up the third and final company and asked how much it would be to Ernestville.
"How much you got?" barked a feisty voice.
Now here was a guy I could do business with. I grinned and said,
"I don't know, $1.50.
There was a snort.
"Well, it's going to cost you more than that."
A pause and the creak of a chair going back.
"It's going to go on what's on the meter, you understand, but I expect it'll be about $20, something like that. What do you want to go to Ernestville for, anyway?"
I explained about Spivey Gap and the AT.
"Appalachian Trail? You must be a dang fool. What time you want to go?"
"I don't know. How about now?"
"Where yet?"
I told him the name of the motel.
"I'll be there in 10 minutes, 15 minutes at the outside. If I'm not there in 20 minutes, then go on ahead without me, and I'll meet you at Ernestville."
He hung up. We had not only found a driver, we'd found a comedian. While we waited on a bench outside the motel office, I bought a copy of the Nashville Tennessean out of a metal box, just to see what was happening in the world. The principal story indicated that the state legislature, in one of those moments of enlightenment with which the southern states often strive to distinguish themselves, was in the process of passing a law forbidding schools from teaching evolution. Instead, they were to be required to instruct that the earth was created by God in 7 days, sometime, before the turn of the century. The article reminded us that this was not a new issue in Tennessee. The little town of Dayton, not far from where Katz and I now sat, as it happened, was the scene of the famous Scopes trial in 1925, when the state prosecuted a schoolteacher named John Thomas Scopes for rashly promulgating Darwinian hogwash. As nearly everyone knows, Clarence Darrow, for the defense, roundly humiliated Williams Jennings Bryan for the prosecution. But what most people don't realize is that Darrow lost the case. Scopes was convicted, and the law wasn't overturned in Tennessee until 1967. And now the state was about to bring the law back, proving conclusively that the danger for Tennesseans isn't so much that they may be descended from apes as overtaken by them. Suddenly, I can't altogether explain it, but suddenly, I had a powerful urge not to be this far south any longer. I turned to Katz. Why don't we go to Virginia? What? Somebody in a shelter a couple of days before had told us how delightful, how gorgeously amenable to hiking, the mountains of the Virginia Blue Ridge were. Once you got up into them, he had assured us, it was nearly all level walking, with sumptuous views over the broad valley of the Shenandoah River. People routinely knocked off 25 miles a day up there. From the vantage of a dank, dripping, smoky shelter, this had sounded like Xanadu, and the idea had stuck. I explained my thinking to Katz. He sat forward intently. Are you saying we leave out all the trail between here and Virginia? Not walk it? Skip it? He seemed to want to make sure he understood this exactly. I nodded. Well, shit, yes! So when the cab driver pulled up a minute later and got out to look us over, I explained to him, hesitantly and a bit haplessly, for I had really not thought this through, that we didn't want to go to Ernestville at all now, but to Virginia. Virginia? He said, as if I had asked him if there was anywhere local we could get a dose of syphilis. He was a little guy, short but built like iron, and at least 70 years old, but real bright, smarter than me and Katz put together, and he grasped the notion of the enterprise before I had halfway explained it. Well, then you want to go to Knoxville and rent a car and drive up to Roanoke. That's what you want to do. I nodded. How do we get to Knoxville? How's a cab sound to you? He barked at me, as if I were three-quarters stupid. I think he might have been a bit hard of hearing, or else he just liked shouting at people. Probably cost you about $50, he said speculatively. Katz and I looked at each other. Yeah, okay, I said, and we got in. And so, just like that, we found ourselves heading for Roanoke and the sweet green hills of old Virginia.